Chapter 7, The Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus teaches in the temple, diverse reactions. Verse 1. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea, because the Judaoi were seeking to kill him. Once Jesus' most dramatic statement about the nature of his person and mission was delivered in Capernaum, he began to spend more time in Galilee. He was avoiding Judea, Judea, because the Judaoi were trying to take his life. This is one of the texts that powerfully connects with the opening statements of the Gospel of John, chapter 1, 11b. His own received him not. The land of Judea, Jesus' natural home, became a place that was hostile even to the point of death. Verse 2. Now the Judaoi's Feast of Booths was at hand. The Feast of Tabernacles, or Booths, also known as Sukkot, is essentially a reenactment of the actions of the Israelites who lived in temporary dwellings, tents, for 40 years from the point of their exodus from Egypt until their entrance into Canaan. This feast was meant to remind subsequent generations of God's sustaining and protecting power throughout the difficult and uncertain journey. As with the Passover, so also with the Feast of Tabernacles, the Israelites were instructed to reenact what happened to their forefathers, so that they and their posterity would remember and identify more fully with their roots. Once again, as with the Passover of the Judaoi, here we are told that this Feast of Tabernacles was also the Feast of the Judaoi. The reason for this statement and similar statements throughout the Gospel of John was not that the non-Jewish readers needed to know that Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles were Jewish holidays, but rather that there were several different calendars in use in that time. It was important to the author of the Gospel to show which calendar Jesus followed. For John, Jesus was a Judean, Judaios, pure and simple. Verse 3. So his brothers said to him, "Live here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you're doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Jesus' brothers, who did not yet believe that their oldest sibling was anything special, said to Jesus, "Sukkot of the Judeans is coming. You're one of them." Note that they referred to Judaoi as Jesus' disciples. By now, his Galilean disciples have witnessed a number of his miracles, but none were performed in Judea. In effect, they are saying, "You must show your signs not only in Galilee, but also in Judea. If you want to be accepted by your own, you must also do your signs in Jerusalem." Once again, John 1:11b, "his own received him not," is the real conceptual context of this conversation between Jesus' brothers and the Lord himself. Verse 5. "For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, 'My time has not yet come, but your time is always here.'" The phrase "my time has not yet come" was first mentioned at the wedding in Cana, John chapter 2, and will be repeated many times over as the story continues to unfold until Jesus' encounter with the Greek God-fearers. Sukkot was one of the three feasts during which every Jewish male was obligated to come to Jerusalem for worship. This would be especially true for those like Jesus who lived relatively close to Jerusalem. His brothers were not surprised by Jesus' decision to skip the trip to Jerusalem this time around. The rumors about his life being endangered were no doubt discussed, not only on the streets, but also in the family circle. Sometime later, however, one of Jesus' brothers would become known as Jacob, James the Just, Yaakov Atzadik. In the decades following Jesus' death and resurrection, Yaakov would lead the Jesus movement that was headquartered in Jerusalem, and he would be considered by many to be the first rightful patriarch of Jerusalem. Acts 15:13 and James 1:1. Verse 7. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to the feast, for my time has not yet fully come. All the evil kings of Israel hated the prophets for not withholding their criticism. One of the reasons King David is portrayed in a positive light is because when he was confronted about his sin by the prophet Nathan, he responded with repentance and faith. King David, who was far from perfect, did not seek to kill the prophet of God. The world to which Jesus belonged, his own in John 1:11, has come to hate him. It is important to remember that John repeatedly shows the relationship between Jesus and the Judaioi as that of one community, one family, and one people group within wider Israel. The world in this context was not all the people on the planet, nor was it all Israelites, and even all the Judeans. It was the system of the Judaioi to whom Jesus belonged by birth and identity. Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, you remember, that sought to take his life and thus put an end to his ministry. Verse 9. After saying this, he remained in Galilee, but after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. As soon as his brothers departed for Jerusalem, Jesus also left and traveled to Jerusalem incognito, something his brothers had not expected. Verse 11. The Judaioi were looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, "He is a good man," others said, "No, he is leading the people astray." Yet, for the fear of the Judaioi, no one spoke openly of him. The Judaioi here are clearly portrayed not simply as Judeans, but as members of the Judean authority. They were looking for Jesus. Notice how the Judaioi here have a separate identity from the people who were also clearly Israelite. The phrase, "among the people," is how the Gospel of John refers to both the people who came to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles and to the ordinary citizens of Judea. These people were engaged in an ongoing but secret conversation about Jesus. What clearly identifies the Judaioi as the Judean authorities here is that not only positive but also negative conversation about Jesus was carried out in secret by the Jewish people present. Jesus was a taboo subject. Everyone knew it, both those who supported him and those who opposed him. The Judean authorities were watching. The walls had ears. Verse 14. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. The Judaioi therefore marveled, saying, "How is it that this man has learning when he has never studied?" The Feast of Tabernacles is a week-long celebration. The Jewish historian Josephus Flavius called this particular feast a most holy and important feast. And we are told that Jesus appeared in the temple and began to speak publicly sometimes after the beginning of the feast. There does not seem to be any particular significance to the fact that Jesus went up to the temple midweek. He probably simply wanted those who were looking for him to let their guard down, since by then they would have already assumed he feared enough for his life not to come at all. When he came to the feast, the Judaioi did not recognize him. This is interesting. Either Jesus' looks were so average that people would not immediately recognize him, or no one who could make an arrest knew him or ever saw him personally. Judas's kiss served to identify Jesus when the temple guard came to arrest him. No one actually knew what Jesus looked like, so Judas's actions were necessary. This is the most likely reason that the Judaioi who heard Jesus speak wondered, "How is it that this man has learning when he never studied?" So Jesus answered them, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. Jesus answered the questions the Iudaioi had not voiced, but were probably asking in their hearts. "You're right, I did not receive approved schooling, but I have a message to bring to you as an authorized representative of Israel's God." In other words, Jesus challenged his hearers to stop thinking of him as a young sage from out of town, but rather begin to think of him as a young prophet from God. After all, a prophet by definition does not need to be schooled by man. He has a higher calling. He must be taught by God. Verse 19. "Has not Moses given you the law, yet none of you keeps the law? Why do you seek to kill me?" The Iudaioi, who were listening to Jesus' speeches and Torah interpretations, did not yet make the connection with the now infamous Jesus. Then suddenly Jesus began to make things clear. But one must admit that the author of this gospel makes a brilliant move here. Remember, he is not talking to Gentiles, nor to the Iudaioi. He has in mind the Samaritan Israelites, who have long said that the Iudaioi do not truly keep the Torah of Moses. By offering this critique of Judean misinterpretation of the Torah, he is able at the same time to help the Samaritan Israelites be emotionally connected to the drama. Verse 20. The crowd answered, "You have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you?" The first reaction was shock and disbelief by some of them, who said in a loud voice, "Are you crazy?" Literally, in the words of ancient Israelites, "You have a demon. No one is after you. Don't be paranoid." But as Jesus continued to speak, some of them began to connect the dots. The people in charge indeed were seeking Jesus' arrest and death. So this was not an exaggeration. Verse 21. Jesus answered them, "I did one work, and all of you marvel at it." It is clear that Jesus was referring to his healing of a Jewish man at the pool of Bethesda, which had occurred during his previous trip to Jerusalem. Remember, the pool in Hellenized Jerusalem very likely functioned as the healing sanctuary of Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine and health. This healing occurred on the Sabbath, and it is likely that Jesus disturbed the public order by walking into the pagan facility and healing someone in the name of Israel's God. As we read, we must also understand that Jewish authorities worked under watchful eye of Roman authority. The Roman Empire had its own values. Jewish beliefs were tolerated as long as they did not infringe on the pagan cults, and this was a case of infringement. Jesus, a Jewish religious leader, wielded his authority and power in the Asclepion. Both the temple authorities and the Romans were very concerned. Therefore, in order to distance themselves from Jesus, the temple authorities accused him of Sabbath desecration. The Iudaioi's blind commitment to stop Jesus and to strip him of his growing popularity closed their eyes to being able to see the obvious. Verse 22. "Moses gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath." If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? Do not judge by appearances, but judge with a right judgment. It was believed that through the sign and seal of circumcision, a person is brought into covenant relationship with Israel's God and as a result is made spiritually whole. Notice, Jesus agrees with the Iudaioi that even though it was the Sabbath day, the circumcision ritual still needed to take place because the sign of circumcision takes precedence over the ordinary Sabbath regulations. As was customary for Jesus, he didn't argue with the Iudaioi about the legitimacy of the Torah of Moses. After all, the Torah of Moses was Jesus' Torah. He only argued with them about its interpretation. Here, he's seen accusing the Yudaioi of the sin, of inconsistency. There was at least one other noteworthy occasion when Jesus accused his opponents of the sin of inconsistency. The Israelite residents of Qumran were not allowed to assist their animals in the birthing process on the Sabbath. This was not out of the lack of concern for the animal's well-being, but out of the concern for working to increase or preserve one's own wealth on the Sabbath day. One example of what made this Jewish movement different from the far more liberal Pharisaic movement was the following prohibition. If it falls into a pit or ditch, he shall not raise it up on the Sabbath. Contrary to popular opinion, Jesus' point in arguing with the Pharisees over healing on the Sabbath was not to call them to repentance from legalism and bad hermeneutical methods, but rather to apply their already developed hermeneutical methods consistently. In a sense, Jesus is saying, "You Pharisees, the enemies of Qumranites, can see the acceptability of caring for an animal in trouble on the Sabbath day, but you refuse me the right to help people who are in trouble on the Sabbath day. You're right, but you are completely inconsistent." Verse 25. Some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, "Is not this man whom they seek to kill? And here he is speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ?" Notice how carefully the author of the Gospel distinguishes between the voices of the hearers, the people of Jerusalem, and the authorities, Yudaioi. Suddenly, the crowds put the pieces together and realize that this must be Jesus, whom the temple authorities have determined to arrest. They had heard about his teaching and miracles in Galilee, but not seeking the approval of Jerusalem was nothing less than a challenge to their leadership. There was no place for them and Jesus together. Either they would remain in power or he would replace them. Verse 27. "But we know where this man comes from, and when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from." We read in verse 27 that it was believed that the Messiah would come from unknown origins. However, to the chief priests and the scribes who were summoned by Herod at the coming of the Magi in the Gospel of Matthew, the answer seemed clear. All agreed that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem of Judea, as spoken by the prophet Micah. However, in this passage in John, some members of the crowd, when they thought that the authorities had finally recognized that Jesus was the Christ, objected that Jesus' origins were known. Because of this, they thought it was a mistake to recognize him as the Christ. So what was expected of the coming Messiah? Would his origins be known or not? You may recall that when Jesus was in Galilee, the Yudaioi said he could not have come down from heaven as he claimed, because they personally knew his parents. In John 7:27, however, it is likely that the author is referring to something else. Instead of a personal acquaintance with Jesus' parents, the likely issue was that Jesus' ministry was already known to them and had been for some time. There was no suddenness in his messianic appearance. In John 7, what people were saying was not that they knew Jesus' Galilean parents, that is rather unlikely, but that they had heard about Jesus for so long that he no longer fitted their messianic candidate checklist. Much later, rabbinic Jewish sources communicate similar sentiments coming from the Jewish sages. For example, in the Babylonian Talmud, Rabbi Zerah is remembered as having said, "Three come unawares: Messiah, a found article, and a scorpion." Another example comes from the 2nd century dialogue between Justin Martyr, a Christian, and Trypho, a Jew. What is interesting is that Trypho's objections are similar to the above. But Christ, if he has indeed been born and existed anywhere, is unknown and does not even know himself and has no power until Elijah comes to anoint him and make him manifest to all. Incidentally, it is entirely possible that the conversation between Justin and Trypho never took place, and the content of the dialogue was simply reconstructed from the New Testament texts alone, a common feature of a polemical religious literature. But it is also possible that this dialogue was put together as a summary of a real Jewish-Christian encounters in the second century. If this is so, then it is possible that this is an example of a widespread Jewish belief that Christ's coming would be sudden and his origins unknown. The idea that Christ would be of unknown origins also appears in 1 Enoch 46, verses 1 to 3. This is another witness to the variety of Jewish contemporary opinions about the secret things of the Messiah. There we read, "There I beheld the Ancient of Days, whose head was like white wool, and with him another, whose countenance resembled that of a man. His countenance was full of grace, like that of one of the holy angels. Then I inquired of one of the angels who went with me and who showed me everything secret concerning the Son of Man, who he was, whence he was, and why he accompanied the Ancient of Days." What we can clearly see from these biblical and parabiblical sources is that Jewish people at the time of Jesus held a variety of views concerning the Messiah, just as modern Christ followers today differ greatly in their expectations regarding the second coming. Verse 28. "So Jesus proclaimed, as he taught in the temple, 'You know me, and you know where I come from, but I have not come on my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know. I know him, for I come from him, and he sent me.'" What is even more striking here is, in contrast to the story found in the Gospel of Matthew regarding Bethlehem, John's Jesus seems to agree with the objection that the Messiah will come from the unknown origins. However, he explains that while the people thought they knew him, in reality, they did not. Since Israel's God sent Jesus, there was a lot more to know about him than what the Judaioi naively already claimed. The question could be asked, why would the gospel that so forcefully connects Jesus with the Judaioi withhold from the readership the obvious connection between Jesus and Judea, seeing that his birthplace was in Bethlehem? The answer may be complicated, but I will try to explain. The gospel was originally written to reach Samaritan Israelites. Samaritan Israelites accepted the Torah and did not accept other sections of the Tanakh, the Old Testament, that Jewish Israelites accepted, namely the writings and the prophets. As we remember from the Samaritan woman story, Samaritans had no trouble acknowledging the supremacy of the tribe of Judah. There Jesus said to the woman, "Salvation is from the Judaioi," referring to the verse in Torah that speaks of the scepter not departing from Judah. She made no objection to it. What the Samaritan Israelites objected to was that the fulfillment of Genesis 49:10 was connected with the Davidic dynasty because they did not accept the leadership of the Davidic dynasty. This is one of the reasons Jesus told the Samaritan woman, "You worship that which you do not know." As we have seen already and will see again, this gospel consistently avoids almost any significant connection between Jesus and King David. Verse 30. "So they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid hand on him, because his hour had not yet come." This phrase, "my time or hour has not yet come," was already in use when Jesus said to his mother in John 2, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." Mary, fully aware of Jesus' divine origins and probably other things that only a mother would know, sought for Jesus to use his miraculous powers to help the embarrassed couple at the height of their wedding joy. Jesus did help, but said that his hour has not yet come. After this incident, Jesus taught the people in the treasury rooms of the temple, and the temple police did not arrest him. The temple police had their own reasons as to why they did not arrest Jesus, but the author of the Gospel of John knew the reason he was not arrested, tried, and killed was because his time had not yet come. However, when the news about Greek God-fearers seeking to meet Jesus came to him, he responded that the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. That happens in John chapter 12. This shows that Jesus was about to be revealed as the King of all Israel. Shortly before his arrest, Jesus prayed, lifting up his eyes to heaven. He said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you." So it is that here, in chapter 7, when Jesus' arrest was being sought, that it could not take place for the simple reason that the hour has not yet come. Verse 31. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, "When the Christ appears, will he not do more miracles than this man has done?" The story begins with people objecting to rumors that the authorities recognize Jesus as the potential Messiah. When the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. But it ends very differently. Many people did believe in him, posing the opposite rhetorical question. When the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done? You can see, just as there were many traditions about the coming of Christ's unknown origins, there were even more traditions that had to do with the coming of Christ's miraculous powers. The Jewish people standing in the crowd were smarter than they seemed, reasoning, if anyone will ever be the Christ, he wouldn't be able to do more miracles than this man, Jesus. Verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. The author makes a very interesting point in this verse. Before the Feast of Tabernacles, people were afraid to talk about Jesus because they were afraid of the Judaioi. However, when Jesus began to openly teach in the temple, the public debate about him could no longer be contained. The Pharisees, who witnessed this debate in the temple, sent the temple guard to make an arrest. The Pharisees had full cooperation of the chief priests. Notice that the chief priests, together with Pharisees, were the very authorities whose powers were enough to dispatch the temple police to arrest Jesus on criminal charges. Now let us recall an early reference in John 1 to an exercise of power against John the Baptist. And this is the testimony of John when the Judaioi sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" Now they have been sent from the Pharisees. We see something similar at play in both of these events. In both cases, sending the priestly commission and sending the temple guard, the Pharisees were involved. In both cases, however, they were not alone. Verse 33. Jesus then said, "I will be with you a little longer, and then I'm going to him who sent me. You will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come." The Judaioi said to one another, "Where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? What does he mean by saying, 'You will seek me and you will not find me,' and 'Where I am, you cannot come'?" When the Pharisees and the chief priests dispatched the temple crowd to arrest him, Jesus was addressing a crowd which was in the middle of a public debate concerning him. He told them that his time with them was coming to an end. He would then return to him who sent him. Notice the power play here. The Judaioi were exercising their authority to send the temple police to arrest Jesus. But Jesus was saying that he was sent by someone who was the ultimate authority, Israel's God himself. Moreover, the place to which Jesus was departing was unapproachable, and he could not be followed. The Judaioi, who remained in the crowd, but separate from it, wondered about the words of Jesus, hypothesizing that Jesus was planning to leave the areas under their control. It is important to realize, when the Judaioi said they thought that Jesus was planning to go to the Greeks, it is probable that they did not mean Greek Gentiles, but anyone, including Israelites, who behaved like Greeks. In this case, probably the Hellenized Jews were in mind. The usual assumption that most Christians make in reading this text is that the Iudaioi thought Jesus was considering going to Gentiles in the lands of the Jewish diaspora. Most importantly, this means that they, the Hellenists, were fully outside of the control of the Iudaioi. This realization must have been disconcerting. Examples of such lack of control by Iudaioi are plentiful. According to archaeological discoveries in Israelite Galilee, there were some older synagogues that were not directly oriented to Jerusalem, and one of them was found in Kfar Nahum. An even more interesting case of alternative Israelite worship was found in Elephantine, an island in the Nile River in the southern Egypt. There, a mixed Judeo-Samaritan-Israelite mercenary colony was stationed from around 650 BCE. The island boasted its own alternative to the Judean and in some way also to the Samaritan temple. A very important, though not well-known, Isaianic prophecy was believed by many to have been fulfilled in Egypt. Isaiah 19, verses 19 to 25. The prophecy of Isaiah reads as follows. In that day there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt. They will even worship with sacrifice and offerings, and will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. In that day Israel will be the third party with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, Blessed is Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel my inheritance. The later Masoretic text has one more verse before the prophecy cited above, where it purposely changes the name of the city of Sun, the likely original, to the city of destruction, a translation that makes no sense at all given the positive context of the prophecy. We read, In that day there will be five cities in the land of Egypt that speak the language of Canaan, land of Israel, and swear allegiance to the Lord of hosts, Israel's God. One of these will be called the City of Sun, changed in the Masoretic version to destruction. What is striking is that both scrolls of Isaiah found in Qumran, Dead Sea Scrolls, and the texts of Isaiah in the Septuagint confirm that in the Hebrew original version, this was the City of the Sun and not the City of Destruction. The reason for this is that both Qumran proto-Masoretic texts and the Septuagint predate the Masoretic texts by many centuries. According to Josephus, there was at least one additional temple in Egypt. This temple was built to resemble the one in Jerusalem and was administered by legitimate priests who actually conducted sacrificial offerings. In other words, this was not a synagogue, but a real temple where sacrificial services regularly took place. It was not located in Jerusalem, which means that Jesus and the Qumranites were not the only Israelites in late antiquity to oppose Jerusalem's leaders, although for different reasons than those in the Egyptian island of Elephantine. Verse 37. On the last day of the feast, the great day, Sadducees and Pharisees were the two Israelite Judean parties that were often at odds with one another. Sadducees were the staunch conservatives who saw Pharisees as dangerous innovators and revisionists, as did many others, including Jesus. Sadducees and Pharisees fought over many issues. One of the issues concerned a water ceremony that was held during the Feast of Tabernacles. The Sadducees opposed the ceremony because it was not prescribed in the Torah, and the Pharisees supported it. We do not know exactly how and where the water pouring ceremonies were conducted, since all of our sources for this information come to us from a later period. In these later sources, we are told that priests drew water from the pool of Siloam. With a high priest leading the way, they carried a golden pitcher full of water to the temple and then processed around the altar. As the priests near the water gate, the shofar was blown, followed by the singing of psalms of praise and thanksgiving to God for the harvest. As the ceremony developed, the Pharisees insisted that significant emphasis should be placed on the petition for rain. Such symbolism carried the meaning of the festival beyond the traditional emphasis of the desert experience, being protected while living in temporary dwellings, tents. The harvest was symbolized in the citrus fruits that were raised in thanksgiving to God for the recently gathered fruits. The Sadducees in general resisted such a changed emphasis on Sukkot as revisionist. The conflict developed further when Alexander Janneus, the Sadducean high priest and king, angered by the Pharisees, poured the water out at his feet rather than making an offering of it, and raised his arm in solemn affirmation of having delivered the petition on behalf of the people. When Janneus died, his wife, Alexandra Salome, made peace with the Pharisees in exchange for their support for her to remain queen for the land and her son to be made high priest. The Pharisees' triumph in this event meant that by the time of Jesus, this Pharisaic water-related ceremony was already firmly established. 37b. Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink." For 6 consecutive days, the water procession took place once each morning, if Talmudic sources are to be believed. On the 7th day, it was repeated 7 times in order to show the emphasis and concentration on prayer and worship. On the 8th day, there was no water ceremony, but a solemn time of reflection and prayer was held. Jesus could have loudly proclaimed this on either the 7th or the 8th day of the feast. Either day could technically be called the last and great day. What is most important here, however, is not when Jesus said it, but what he said and what he expected the people to understand. Without getting into Sadducean-Pharisaic debate discussed previously, Jesus declared that all those who are thirsty may come to him and drink. The connection between what had just taken place, an incredibly festive water-pouring ceremony, and Jesus' words are obvious and do not require much explanation. The surrounding context offered a dramatic backdrop for these brief but powerful words of Jesus. Verse 38. "Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his womb will flow rivers of living water." There are times when it is not at all clear what portion of the Old Testament scriptures is being referred to in the New Testament, and this is the case with this text. Which Old Testament reference does Jesus have in mind here? The choices are plentiful, all having to do with water and salvation-related passages. Before we select the most likely reference, we should ask one more question, which will provide us with a potential key for solving this riddle. If Jesus is the one of whom the scripture spoke, out of his inner being, heart, belly, or literally womb, will flow rivers of living water, we must look for connections in the context of what had already happened, chapters 1 to 6, and also to what is presently occurring here in chapter 7. Jesus is portrayed as tabernacle in John 1:14, as a temple in John 2:13-25. Of the 4 canonical Gospels, the Gospel of John is without a doubt the most temple-oriented. This should give us a clue that the likely reference alluded to here may have something to do with the temple. We should be especially interested in a text that connects the Feast of Tabernacles with the temple where this discussion was taking place. Once we consider the Hebrew Bible's water and salvation-related themes explicitly connected with the temple, one reference in particular becomes a promising interpretive possibility. Ezekiel 47, verses 1 to 12. The text of Ezekiel describes the future temple out of which flows a river. The angelic figure accompanying Ezekiel measured the water, which became increasingly deep. Then a vision of a blessed future was given. The desert region, together with the salty Dead Sea, would flourish. Because of this river of living water, the deadness of the desert would become a place of life and healing. The question is, does Ezekiel 47 explicitly connect with John 7:38? I believe it does. We read in Ezekiel 47, verse 1, "Then he brought me back to the door of the house, and behold, water was flowing from under the threshold of the house toward the east, for the house faced east." That is to say, it is from within the temple that this end-time river would issue. Jesus said that whoever believes in him will be joined to him. Then together they will be that end-time temple of God from which the river of life and healing will flow, making everything new. What is even more exciting is that a parallel passage to this Ezekiel text is found in Zechariah 14. There we read about an eschatological battle during and after which rivers of living water begin to flow in two directions, west and east, from Jerusalem temple. When the battle is finished and Israel's God emerges a clear winner, the defeated and surviving nations who fought against Jerusalem will come each year to Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles before the face of the Lord. The very feast in this chapter in which Jesus is described as participating. In these two references, you have all the themes which firmly connect the two passages with the events described in John 7. Incidentally, there is some indication that these texts were actually read out loud as a part of the water pouring ceremony. It is possible that following the reading of these very words, Jesus got up and proclaimed that it is in him that the words of the prophets will be fulfilled, evoking imagery of a eschatological temple, providing running, living water to Israel from within his own depths. As with most things Jesus says in the Gospels, and especially in the Gospel of John, these words are earth-shattering in their meaning and implication. Jesus is the temple, and from his heart, the water of life will soon begin to flow. Verse 39. "Now this he said about the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for as yet the Spirit had not been given, because Jesus was not yet glorified." This verse then becomes clear. What Jesus said about the rivers of the living water, according to John's editorial and retrospective comment, had to do with the outpouring of the Spirit during the festival of Pentecost, or Shavuot. According to John, the believers had no knowledge of this because the Pentecost events described in Acts 2 were still in the future. Verse 40. "On hearing his words, some of the people said, 'Surely this man is the prophet.' Others said, 'He is the Messiah.' Still others asked, 'How can the Messiah come from Galilee? Does not Scripture say that the Messiah will come from David's descendants and from Bethlehem, the town where David lived?' Thus, the people were divided because of Jesus." Jesus' challenges to the authorities and his incredible claims were received rather well. Some said that perhaps he was the prophet who was to announce the Messiah. Others said that he was indeed the Messiah. There seemed to be a general lack of knowledge about Jesus' origins, because we also see other people saying they rejected Jesus' claim on the grounds that he was not born in Bethlehem of Judea. One of the very interesting observations here is that the author of this gospel did not feel any need to correct this misconception, although doubtless he, like others, knew that Jesus was in fact born in Bethlehem of Judea. Perhaps his point was only to show that public conversation about Jesus had picked up a momentum, regardless of how people viewed Jesus' claims. Verse 44. "Some wanted to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him. Finally, the temple guards went back to the chief priests and the Pharisees, who asked them, 'Why didn't you bring him in?' 'No one ever spoke the way this man does,' the guards replied." "You mean he has deceived you also?" the Pharisees retorted. When the temple guard, made up of Levitical priests, returned without having arrested Jesus and admitted that they were impressed with him, they were met with a sharp rebuke by the leading Pharisaic leadership, accompanied by the charge of disloyalty. It was obvious that the formal rulers of Israel were afraid and losing power over those whose allegiance they thought they owned. Verse 48. Have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed in him? No, but this mob that knows nothing of the law, there is a curse on them. Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier and who was one of their own number, asked, Does our Torah condemn a man without first hearing to find out what he had been doing? They replied, Are you from Galilee too? Look into it, and you will find that a prophet does not come out of Galilee. This delegitimization of the temple guards in action was also challenged by the statement, also a mistaken one, that none of the Pharisees who were part of the Sanhedrin accepted Jesus. It is of a particular interest to see how John treats this misconception. Instead of arguing that indeed they were Pharisaic members of the Sanhedrin who displayed a profound interest in Jesus and his ministry, remember, Rabbi, we know that you have come from God. John simply showed how those who rejected Jesus dismissed the testimony of those who voiced even a tentative support of him. Nicodemus is a case in point. When he asked for the Sanhedrin's hearing about Jesus, challenging its prejudgment as unlawful according to the Torah, he was also accused of disloyalty to the system. The message was clear. If anyone, regardless of their position, thought something positive about Jesus, they could not voice it without being attacked. The shameful silence was the price believing Judaoi had to pay to remain part of this dying system.